comments. Where formerly a dozen people came and stayed all afternoon, three men and a secretary to take the notes now get the matter over with within an hour or so, and no one feels left out. Many executives know all about these unproductive and unnecessary time demands, yet they're afraid to prune them. They're afraid to cut out something important by mistake, but this mistake, if made, can be speedily corrected. If one prunes too harshly, one usually finds out fast enough. Every new president of the United States accepts too many invitations at first. Then it dawns on him that he has other work to do and that most of these invitations don't add to his effectiveness. Thereupon, he usually cuts back too sharply and becomes inaccessible. A few weeks or months later, however, he's being told by the press and the radio that he's losing touch. Then he usually finds the right balance between being exploited without effectiveness and using public appearances as his national pulpit. In fact, there's not much risk that an executive will cut back too much. We usually tend to overrate rather than underrate our importance and to conclude that far too many things can only be done by ourselves. Even very effective executives still do a great many unnecessary, unproductive things. But the best proof that the danger of overpruning is a bugaboo is the extraordinary effectiveness so often attained by severely ill or severely handicapped people. A good example was Harry Hopkins, President Roosevelt's confidential advisor in World War II. A dying, indeed almost a dead man for whom every step was torment, he could only work a few hours every other day or so. This forced him to cut out everything but truly vital matters. He didn't lose effectiveness thereby. On the contrary, he became, as Churchill called him once, Lord Heart of the Matter, and accomplished more than anyone else in wartime Washington. This is an extreme, of course, but it illustrates both how much control one can exercise over one's time if one really tries, and how much of the time wasters one can cut out without loss of effectiveness. Pruning the time wasters. The following three diagnostic questions deal with unproductive and time-consuming activities over which every executive has some control. Every knowledge worker and every executive should ask them. Managers, however, need to be equally concerned with time loss that results from poor management and deficient organization. Poor management wastes everybody's time, but above all, it wastes the manager's time. 1. The first task here is to identify the time wasters which follow from lack of system or foresight. The symptom to look for is the recurrent crisis, the crisis that comes back year after year. A crisis that recurs a second time is a crisis that mustn't occur again. The annual inventory crisis belongs here. That with the computer we now can meet it even more heroically and at greater expense than we could in the past is hardly a great improvement. A recurrent crisis should always have been foreseen. It can therefore either be prevented or reduced to a routine which clerks can manage. The definition of a routine is that it makes unskilled people without judgment capable of doing what it took near genius to do before, for a routine puts down in systematic step-by-step form what a very able man learned in surmounting yesterday's crisis. The recurrent crisis isn't confined to the lower levels of an organization. It afflicts everyone. For years, a fairly large company ran into one of these crises annually around the 1st of December. In a highly seasonal business, with the last quarter usually the year's low, fourth quarter sales and profits weren't easily predictable. Every year, however, management made an earnings prediction when it issued its interim report at the end of the second quarter. 3 months later, in the fourth quarter, there was tremendous scurrying and company-wide emergency action to live up to top management's forecast. For 3 to 5 weeks, nobody in the management group got any work done. It took only one stroke of the pen to solve this crisis. Instead of predicting a definite year-end figure, top management is now predicting results within a range. This fully satisfies directors, stockholders, and the financial community, and what used to be a crisis a few years ago now is no longer even noticed in the company, yet fourth quarter results are quite a bit better than they used to be, since executive time is no longer being wasted on making results fit the forecast. Prior to Mr. McNamara's appointment as Secretary of Defense, a similar last-minute crisis shook the entire American defense establishment every spring toward the end of the fiscal year on June 30th. Every manager in the defense establishment, military or civilian, tried desperately in May and June to find expenditures for the money appropriated by Congress for the fiscal year. Otherwise, he was afraid he would have to give back the money. This last-minute spending spree has also been a chronic disease in Russian planning. And yet this crisis was totally unnecessary, as Mr. McNamara immediately saw. The law had always permitted the placing of unspent but needed sums into an interim account. The recurrent crisis is simply a symptom of slovenliness and laziness. Years ago, when I first started out as a consultant, I had to learn how to tell a well-managed industrial plant from a poorly managed one without any pretense to production knowledge. A well-managed plant, I soon learned, is a quiet place, a factory that is dramatic, a factory in which the epic of industry is unfolded before the visitor's eyes, is poorly managed. A well-managed factory is boring. Nothing exciting happens in it because the crises have been anticipated and have been converted into routine. Similarly, a well-managed organization is a dull organization. The dramatic things in such an organization are basic decisions that make the future rather than heroics in mopping up yesterday. 2. Time wastes often result from overstaffing. My first grade arithmetic primer asked, "If it takes 2 ditch diggers 2 days to dig a ditch, how long would it take 4 ditch diggers?" In first grade, the correct answer is, of course, 1 day. In the kind of work, however, with which executives are concerned, the right answer is probably 4 days, if not forever. A workforce may indeed be too small for the task, and the work then suffers if it gets done at all, but this isn't the rule. Much more common is the workforce that's too big for effectiveness, the workforce that spends, therefore, an increasing amount of its time interacting rather than working. There's a fairly reliable symptom of overstaffing if the senior people in the group, and of course the manager in particular, spend more than a small fraction of their time, maybe one-tenth, on problems of human relations, on feuds and frictions, on jurisdictional disputes and questions of cooperation and so on, then the workforce is almost certainly too large. People get into each other's way. People have become an impediment to performance rather than the means thereto. In a lean organization, people have room to move without colliding with one another and can do their work without having to explain it all the time. The excuse for overstaffing is always, "But we have to have a thermodynamicist or a patent lawyer or an economist on the staff. This specialist isn't being used much. He may not be used at all, but we have to have him around just in case we need him. And he always has to be familiar with our problem and be part of the group from the start." One should only have on a team the knowledges and skills that are needed day in and day out for the bulk of the work. Specialists that may be needed once in a while or that may have to be consulted on this or on that should always remain outside. It's infinitely cheaper to go to them and consult them against a fee than to have them in the group, to say nothing of the impact an underemployed but overskilled man has on the effectiveness of the entire group. All he can do is mischief. 3. Another common time waster is malorganization. Its symptom is an excess of meetings. Meetings are by definition a concession to deficient organization. For one either meets or one works. One cannot do both at the same time. In an ideally designed structure, which in a changing world is of course only a dream, there would be no meetings. Everybody would know what he needs to know to do his job. Everyone would have the resources available to him to do his job. We meet because people holding different jobs have to cooperate to get a specific task done. We meet because the knowledge and experience needed in a specific situation aren't available in one head, but have to be pieced together out of the experience and knowledge of several people. There will always be more than enough meetings. Organization will always require so much working together that the attempts of well-meaning behavioral scientists to create opportunities for cooperation may be somewhat redundant, but if executives in an organization spend more than a fairly small part of their time in meeting, it's a sure sign of malorganization. Every meeting generates a host of little follow-up meetings, some formal, some informal, but both stretching out for hours. Meetings therefore need to be purposefully directed. An undirected meeting is not just a nuisance, it's a danger. But above all, meetings have to be the exception rather than the rule. An organization in which everybody meets all the time is an organization in which no one gets anything done. Wherever a time log shows the fatty degeneration of meetings, whenever, for instance, people in an organization find themselves in meetings a quarter of their time or more, there's time-wasting malorganization. There are exceptions, special organs whose purpose it is to meet. The boards of directors, for instance, of such companies as DuPont and Standard Oil of New Jersey, which are the final organs of deliberation and appeal, but which don't operate anything. But as these two companies realized a long time ago, The people who sit on these boards can't be permitted to do anything else, for the same reason, by the way, that judges can't be permitted to be also advocates in their spare time. As a rule, meetings should never be allowed to become the main demand on an executive's time. Too many meetings always bespeak poor structure of jobs and the wrong organizational components. Too many meetings signify that work that should be in one job or in one component is spread over several jobs or several components. They signify that responsibility is diffused and that information isn't addressed to the people who need it. In one large company, the root cause of an epidemic of meetings was a traditional but obsolescent organization of the energy business. Large steam turbines, the company's traditional business since before 1900, were one division under their own management and with their own staff. During World War II, however, the company also went into aircraft engines and, as a result, had organized in another division concerned with aircraft and defense production a large jet engine capacity. Finally, there was an atomic energy division, really an offspring of the research labs, and still organizationally more or less tied to them. But today, these three power sources are no longer separate, each with its own market. Increasingly, they are becoming substitutes for, as well as complements to, each other. Each of the three is the most economical and most advantageous generating equipment for electric power under certain conditions. In this sense, the three are competitive. But by putting two of them together, one can also obtain performance capacities which no one type of equipment by itself possesses. What the company needed, clearly, was an energy strategy. It needed a decision whether to push all three types of generating equipment in competition with each other, whether to make one of the three the main business and consider the other two supplementary, or finally, whether to develop two of the three, and which two, as one energy package. It needed a decision how to divide available capital among the three. Above all, however, the energy business needed an organization which expressed the reality of one energy market producing the same end product, electric power, for the same customers. Instead, there were three components, each carefully shielded from the others by layers of organization, each having its own special folkways, rituals, and its own career ladders, and each blithely confident that it would get by itself 75% of the total energy business of the next decade. As a result, the three were engaged in a non-stop meeting for years. Since each reported to a different member of management, these meetings sucked in the entire top group. Finally, the three were cut loose from their original groups and put together into one organizational component under one manager. There's still a good deal of infighting going on, and the big strategy decisions still have to be made, but at least there's understanding now as to what these decisions are. At least top management no longer has to chair and referee every meeting, and total meeting time is a fraction of what it used to be. 4. The last major time waster is malfunction in information. The administrator of a large hospital was plagued for years by telephone calls from doctors asking him to find a bed for one of their patients who should be hospitalized. The admissions people knew that there was no empty bed, yet the administrator almost invariably found a few. The admissions people simply weren't informed immediately when a patient was discharged. The floor nurse knew, of course, and so did the people in the front office who presented the bill to the departing patient. The admissions people, however, got a bed count made every morning at 5 a.m., while the great majority of patients were being sent home in mid-morning after the doctors had made the rounds. It didn't take genius to put this right. All it needed was an extra carbon copy of the chit that goes from the floor nurse to the front office. Even worse, but equally common, is information in the wrong form. Manufacturing businesses typically suffer from production figures that have to be translated before operating people can use them. They report averages, that is, they report what the accountants need. Operating people, however, usually need not the averages but the range and the extremes, product mix and production fluctuations, length of runs, and so on. To get what they need, they must either spend hours each day adapting the averages or build their own secret accounting organization. The accountant has all the information, but no one, as a rule, has thought of telling him what's needed. Time-wasting management defects such as overstaffing, malorganization, or malfunctioning information can sometimes be remedied fast. At other times, it takes long patient work to correct them. The results of such work are, however, great, and especially in terms of time gained. consolidating discretionary time. The executive who records and analyzes his time and then attempts to manage it can determine how much he has for his important tasks. How much time is there that is discretionary, that is, available for the big tasks that will really make a contribution? It's not going to be a great deal, no matter how ruthlessly the executive prunes time wasters. One of the most accomplished time managers I've ever met was the president of a big bank with whom I worked for 2 years on top management structure. I saw him once a month for 2 years. My appointment was always for an hour and a half. The president was always prepared for the sessions, and I soon learned to do my homework, too. There was never more than one item on the agenda, but when I had been in there for an hour and 20 minutes, the president would turn to me and say, "Mr. Drucker, I believe you'd better sum up now and outline what we should do next." And an hour and 30 minutes after I'd been ushered into his office, he was at the door shaking my hand and saying goodbye. After this had been going on for about 1 year, I finally asked him, "Why always an hour and a half?" He answered, "That's easy. I have found that my attention span is about an hour and a half. If I work on any one topic longer than this, I begin to repeat myself. At the same time, I have learned that nothing of importance can really be tackled in much less time. One does not get to the point where one understands what one is talking about." During the hour and a half I was in his office every month, there was never a telephone call, and his secretary never stuck her head in the door to announce that an important man wanted to see him urgently. One day I asked him about this. He said, "My secretary has strict instructions not to put anyone through except the President of the United States and my wife. The President rarely calls, and my wife knows better. Everything else the secretary holds till I have finished. Then I have half an hour in which I return every call and make sure I get every message. I have yet to come across a crisis which could not wait 90 minutes. Needless to say, this president accomplished more in this one monthly session than many other and equally able executives get done in a month of meetings. But even this disciplined man had to resign himself to having at least half his time taken up by things of minor importance and dubious value, things that nonetheless had to be done. The seeing of important customers who just dropped in, attendance at meetings which could just as well have proceeded without him, specific decisions on daily problems that shouldn't have reached him but invariably did. Whenever I see a senior executive asserting that more than half his time is under his control and is really discretionary time which he invests and spends according to his own judgment, I'm reasonably certain that he has no idea where his time goes. Senior executives rarely have as much as one quarter of their time truly at their disposal and available for the important matters, the matters that contribute, the matters that are being paid for. This is true in any organization, except that in the government agency, the unproductive time demands on the top people tend to be even higher than they are in other large organizations. The higher up an executive, the larger will be the proportion of time that's not under his control and yet not spent on contribution. The larger the organization, the more time will be needed just to keep the organization together and running rather than to make it function and produce. The effective executive therefore knows that he has to consolidate his discretionary time. He knows that he needs large chunks of time and that small driblets are no time at all. Even one quarter of the working day, if consolidated in large time units, is usually enough to get the important things done, but even three quarters of the working day are useless if they're only available as 15 minutes here or half an hour there. The final step in time management is therefore to consolidate the time that record and analysis show as normally available and under the executive's control. There are a good many ways of doing this. Some people, usually senior men, work at home one day a week. This is a particularly common method of time consolidation for editors or research scientists. Other men schedule all the operating work, the meetings, reviews, problem sessions, and so on, for 2 days a week. For example, Monday and Friday, and set aside the mornings of the remaining days for consistent, continuing work on major issues. This was how the bank president handled his time. Monday and Friday he had his operating meetings, saw senior executives on current matters, was available to important customers, and so on. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday afternoons were left unscheduled for whatever might come up, and something, of course, always did, whether urgent personnel problems, a surprise visit by one of the bank's representatives from abroad, or by an important customer, or a trip to Washington. But in the mornings of these 3 days, he scheduled the work on the major matters in chunks of 90 minutes each. Another fairly common method is to schedule a daily work period at home in the morning. One of the most effective executives in Professor Soon Carlson's study, which we just discussed, spent 90 minutes each morning before going to work in a study without telephone at home. Even if this means working very early so as to get to the office on time, it's preferable to the most popular way of getting to the important work, taking it home in the evening and spending 3 hours after dinner on it. By that time, most executives are too tired to do a good job. Certainly those of middle age or older are better off going to bed earlier and getting up earlier, and the reason why working home nights is so popular is actually its worst feature. It enables an executive to avoid tackling his time and its management during the day. But the method by which one consolidates one's discretionary time is far less important than the approach. Most people tackle the job by trying to push the secondary, the less productive matters, together, thus clearing, so to speak, a free space between them. This doesn't lead very far, however. One still gives priority in one's mind and in one's schedule to the less important things, the things that have to be done even though they contribute little. As a result, any new time pressure is likely to be satisfied at the expense of the discretionary time and of the work that should be done in it. Within a few days or weeks, the entire discretionary time will then be gone again, nibbled away by new crises, new immediacies, new trivia. Effective executives start out by estimating how much discretionary time they can realistically call their own. Then they set aside continuous time in the appropriate amount, and if they find later that other matters encroach on this reserve, they scrutinize their record again and get rid of some more time demands from less than fully productive activities. They know that, as has been said before, one rarely overprunes. And all effective executives control their time management perpetually. They not only keep a continuing log and analyze it periodically, they set themselves deadlines for the important activities based on their judgment of their discretionary time. One highly effective man I know keeps two such lists, one of the urgent and one of the unpleasant things that have to be done, each with a deadline. When he finds his deadline slipping, he knows his time is again getting away from him. Time is the scarcest resource, and unless it's managed, nothing else can be managed. The analysis of one's time, moreover, is the one easily accessible and yet systematic way to analyze one's work and to think through what really matters in it. Know thyself, the old prescription for wisdom, is almost impossibly difficult for mortal men, but everyone can follow the injunction, know thy time, if he wants to, and be well on the road toward contribution and effectiveness. Chapter 3. What can I contribute? The effective executive focuses on contribution. He looks up from his work and outward toward goals. He asks, what can I contribute that will significantly affect the performance and the results of the institution I serve? He stresses on responsibility. The focus on contribution is the key to effectiveness. In a man's own work, its content, its level, its standards, and its impact, in his relations with others, his superiors, his associates, his subordinates, in his use of the tools of the executive, such as meetings or reports. The great majority of executives tend to focus downward. They're occupied with efforts rather than with results. They worry over what the organization and their superiors owe them and should do for them, and they're conscious above all of the authority they should have. As a result, they render themselves ineffectual. The head of one of the large management consulting firms always starts an assignment with a new client by spending a few days visiting the senior executives of the client organization one by one. After he's chatted with them about the assignment and the client organization, its history and its people, he asks, though rarely, of course, in these words, and what do you do that justifies your being on the payroll? The great majority, he reports, answer, I run the accounting department, or I'm in charge of the sales force. Indeed, not uncommonly the answer is, I have 850 people working under me. Only a few say, it's my job to give our managers the information they need to make the right decisions, or I'm responsible for finding out what products the customer will want tomorrow, or I have to think through and prepare the decisions the president will have to face tomorrow. The man who focuses on efforts and who stresses his downward authority is a subordinate no matter how exalted his title and rank, but the man who focuses on contribution and who takes responsibility for results no matter how junior is in the most literal sense of the phrase top management. He holds himself accountable for the performance of the whole. The executive's own commitment. The focus on contribution turns the executive's attention away from his own specialty, his own narrow skills, his own department, and toward the performance of the whole. It turns his attention to the outside, the only place where there are results. He's likely to have to think through what relationships his skills, his specialty, his function, or his department have to the entire organization and its purpose. He therefore will also come to think in terms of the customer, the client, or the patient, who's the ultimate reason for whatever the organization produces, whether it be economic goods, governmental policies, or health services. As a result, what he does and how he does it will be materially different. A large scientific agency of the U.S. government found this out a few years ago. The old director of publications retired. He had been with the agency since its inception in the 1930s and was neither scientist nor trained writer. The publications which he turned out were often criticized for lacking professional polish. He was replaced by an accomplished science writer. The publications immediately took on a highly professional look, but the scientific community for whom these publications were intended stopped reading them. A highly respected university scientist who had for many years worked closely with the agency finally told the administrator, "The former director was writing for us. Your new man writes at us." The old director had asked the question, "What can I contribute to the results of this agency?" His answer was, "I can interest the young scientists on the outside in our work, can make them want to come to work for us." He therefore stressed major problems, major decisions, and even major controversies inside the agency. This had brought him more than once into head-on collisions with the administrator, but the old man had stood by his guns. "The test of our publication is not whether we like them. The test is how many young scientists apply to us for jobs and how good they are," he said. "To ask what can I contribute is to look for the unused potential in the job, and what's considered excellent performance in a good many positions is often but a pale shadow of the job's full potential of contribution." The agency department in a large American commercial bank is usually considered a profitable but humdrum activity. This department acts for a fee as the registrar and stock transfer agent for the securities of corporations. It keeps the names of stockholders on record, issues and mails their dividend checks, and does a host of similar clerical chores, all demanding precision and high efficiency, but rarely great imagination. Or so it seemed until a new agency vice president in a large New York bank asked the question, "What could agency contribute?" He then realized that the work brought him into direct contact with the senior financial executives of the bank's customers who make the buying decisions on all banking services, deposits, loans, investments, pension fund management, and so on. Of course, the agency department by itself has to be run efficiently, but as this new vice president realized, its greatest potential was as a sales force for all the other services of the bank. Under its new head, agency, formerly an efficient paper pusher, became a highly successful marketing force for the entire bank. Executives who don't ask themselves, "What can I contribute?" aren't likely to aim too low. They're likely to aim at the wrong things. Above all, they may define their contribution too narrowly. Contribution, as the two illustrations just given show, may mean different things, for every organization needs performance in three major areas. It needs direct results, building of values and their reaffirmation, and building and developing people for tomorrow. If deprived of performance in any one of these areas, it will decay and die. All three, therefore, have to be built into the contribution of every executive, but their relative importance varies greatly with the personality and the position of the executive, as well as with the needs of the organization. The direct results of an organization are clearly visible, as a rule. In a business, their economic results, such as sales and profits. In a hospital, their patient care, and so on. But even direct results aren't totally unambiguous, as the example of the agency vice president in the bank illustrates, and when there's confusion as to what they should be, there are no results. One example is the performance, or rather lack of performance, of the nationalized airlines of Great Britain. They're supposed to be run as a business. They are also supposed to be run as an instrument of British national policy and Commonwealth cohesion, but they've been run largely to keep alive the British aircraft industry. Whipsaw between three different concepts of direct results, they've done poorly in respect to all three. direct results always come first. In the care and feeding of an organization, they play the role calories play in the nutrition of the human body. But any organization also needs a commitment to values and their constant reaffirmation, as a human body needs vitamins and minerals. There has to be something this organization stands for, or else it degenerates into disorganization, confusion, and paralysis. In a business, the value commitment may be to technical leadership, or, as in Sears Roebuck, to finding the right goods and services for the American family and to procuring them at the lowest price and the best quality. Value commitments like results aren't unambiguous. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has for many years been torn between two fundamentally incompatible value commitments, one to agricultural productivity and one to the family farm as the backbone of the nation. The former has been pushing the country toward industrial agriculture, highly mechanical, highly industrialized, and essentially a large-scale commercial business. The latter has called for nostalgia supporting a non-producing rural proletariat, but because farm policy, at least until very recently, has wavered between two different value commitments, all it's really succeeded in doing has been to spend prodigious amounts of money. Finally, organization is, to a large extent, a means of overcoming the limitations mortality sets to what one man can contribute. An organization that's not capable of perpetuating itself has failed. An organization, therefore, has to provide today the men who can run it tomorrow. It has to renew its human capital. It should steadily upgrade its human resources. The next generation should take for granted what the hard work and dedication of this generation has accomplished. They should then, standing on the shoulders of their predecessors, establish a new high as the baseline for the generation after them. An organization which just perpetuates today's level of vision, excellence, and accomplishment has lost the capacity to adapt, and, since the one and only thing certain in human affairs is change, it won't be capable of survival in a changed tomorrow. An executive's focus on contribution by itself is a powerful force in developing people. People adjust to the level of the demands made on them. The executive who sets his sights on contribution raises the sights and standards of everyone with whom he works. A new hospital administrator, holding his first staff meeting, thought that a rather difficult matter had been settled to everyone's satisfaction when one of the participants suddenly asked, "Would this have satisfied Nurse Brian?" At once the argument started all over and didn't subside until a new and much more ambitious solution to the problem had been hammered out. Nurse Brian, the administrator learned, had been a long-serving nurse at the hospital. She wasn't particularly distinguished, hadn't in fact ever become a supervisor, but whenever a decision on patient care came up on her floor, Nurse Brian would ask, "Are we doing the best we can do to help this patient?" Patients on Nurse Brian's floor did better and recovered faster. Gradually over the years, the whole hospital has learned to adopt what came to be known as Nurse Brian's rule, had learned, in other words, to ask, "Are we really making the best contribution to the purpose of this hospital?" Though Nurse Brian herself had retired almost 10 years earlier, the standards she'd set still made demands on people who, in terms of training and position, were her superiors. Commitment to contribution is commitment to responsible effectiveness. Without it, a man shortchanges himself, deprives his organization, and cheats the people he works with. The most common cause of executive failure is inability or unwillingness to change with the demands of a new position. The executive who keeps on doing what he's done successfully before he moved is almost bound to fail. Not only do the results change to which his contribution ought to direct itself, the relative importance between the three dimensions of performance changes. The executive who fails to understand this will suddenly do the wrong things the wrong way, even though he does exactly what in his old job had been the right things done the right way. This was the main reason for the failure of so many able men as executives in World War II Washington. That Washington was political, or the men who had always been on their own suddenly found themselves cogs in a big machine, were at most contributing factors. Plenty of men proved themselves highly effective Washington executives, even though they had no political sense or had never worked in anything bigger than a two-man law practice. Robert E. Sherwood, a most effective administrator in the large Office of War Information and the author of one of the most perceptive books on effectiveness and power, had been a playwright whose earlier organization had consisted of his own desk and typewriter. The men who succeeded in wartime Washington focused on contribution. As a result, they changed both what they did and the relative weight they gave to each of the value dimensions in their work. The failures worked much harder in a good many cases, but they didn't challenge themselves, and they failed to see the need for redirecting their efforts. An outstanding example of success was the man who, already 60, became chief executive officer of a large nationwide chain of retail stores. This man had been in the second spot in the company for 20 years or more. He served contentedly under an outgoing and aggressive chief executive officer who was actually several years younger. He never expected to be president himself, but his boss died suddenly while still in his 50s, and the faithful lieutenant had to take over. The new head had come up as a financial man and was at home with figures, the costing system, purchasing and inventory, the financing of new stores, traffic studies, and so on. People were by and large a shadowy abstraction to him, but when he suddenly found himself president, he asked himself, what can I and no one else do, which, if done really well, would make a real difference to this company? The one truly significant contribution, he concluded, would be the development of tomorrow's managers. The company had prided itself for many years on its executive development policies, but, the new chief executive argued, a policy does nothing by itself. My contribution is to make sure that this actually gets done. From then on, for the rest of his tenure, he walked through the personnel department 3 times a week on his way back from lunch and picked up at random 8 or 10 file folders of young men in the supervisory group. Back in his office, he opened the first man's folder, scanned it rapidly, and put through a telephone call to the man's superior. Mr. Robertson, this is the president in New York. You have on your staff a young man, Joe Jones. Didn't you recommend 6 months ago that he be put in a job where he could acquire some merchandising experience? You did. Why haven't you done anything about it? And down would go the receiver. The next folder opened, he would call another manager in another city. Mr. Smith, this is the president in New York. I understand that you recommended a young man on your staff, Dick Rowe, for a job in which he can learn something about store accounting. I just noticed that you have followed through with this recommendation, and I want to tell you how pleased I am to see you working at the development of our young people. This man was in the president's chair only a few years before he himself retired, but today, 10 or 15 years later, executives who never met him attribute to him, and with considerable justice, the tremendous growth and success of the company since his time. That he asked himself, what can I contribute, also seems to explain in large part the extraordinary effectiveness of Robert McNamara as U.S. Secretary of Defense, a position for which he was completely unprepared when President Kennedy, in the fall of 1960, plucked him out of the Ford Motor Company and put him into the toughest cabinet job. McNamara, who at Ford had been the perfect inside man, was, for instance, totally innocent of politics and tried to leave congressional liaison to subordinates, but after a few weeks he realized that the Secretary of Defense depends on congressional understanding and support. As a result, he forced himself to do what for so publicity-shy and non-political a man must have been both difficult and distasteful, to cultivate Congress, to get to know the influential men on the congressional committees, and to acquire a mastery of the strange art of congressional infighting. He's surely not been completely successful in his dealings with Congress, but he's done better than any earlier secretary. The McNamara story shows that the higher the position an executive holds, the larger will the outside loom in his contribution. No one else in the organization can, as a rule, move as freely on the outside. Perhaps the greatest shortcoming of the present generation of university presidents in the United States is their inside focus on administration, on money raising, and so on, yet no other administrator in the large university is free to establish contact with the students who are the university's customers. Alienation of the students from the administration is certainly a major factor in the student unhappiness and unrest that underlay, for instance, the Berkeley riots at the University of California in 1965. How to make the specialist effective. For the knowledge worker to focus on contribution is particularly important. This alone can enable him to contribute at all. Knowledge workers do not produce a thing. They produce ideas, information, concepts. The knowledge worker, moreover, is usually a specialist. In fact, he can, as a rule, be effective only if he's learned to do one thing very well, that is, if he's specialized. By itself, however, a specialty is a fragment and sterile. Its output has to be put together with the output of other specialists before it can produce results. The task isn't to breed generalists, it's to enable the specialist to make himself and his specialty effective. This means that he must think through who is to use his output and and what the user needs to know and to understand to be able to make productive the fragment the specialist produces. It's popular today to believe that our society is divided into scientists and laymen. It's then easy to demand that the layman learn a little bit of the scientist's knowledge, his terminology, his tools, and so on. But if society was ever divided that way, it was 100 years ago. Today, almost everybody in modern organization is an expert with a high degree of specialized knowledge, each with its own tools, its own concerns, and its own jargon. And the sciences, in turn, have all become splintered to the point where one kind of physicist finds it difficult to comprehend what another kind of physicist is concerned with. The cost accountant is as much a scientist as the biochemist in the sense that he has his own special area of knowledge with its own assumptions, its own concerns, and its own language. And so is the market researcher and the computer logician, the budget officer of the government agency, and the psychiatric caseworker in the hospital. Each of these has to be understood by others before he can be effective. The man of knowledge has always been expected to take responsibility for being understood. It's barbarian arrogance to assume that the layman can and should make the effort to understand him, and that it's enough if the man of knowledge talks to a handful of fellow experts who are his peers. Even in the university or in the research laboratory, this attitude, alas only too common today, condemns the expert to uselessness and converts his knowledge from learning into pedantry. If a man wants to be an executive, that is, if he wants to be considered responsible for his contribution, he has to concern himself with the usability of his product, that is, his knowledge. Effective executives know this, for they're almost imperceptibly led by their upward orientation into finding out what the other fellow needs, what the other fellow sees, and what the other fellow understands. Effective executives find themselves asking other people in the organization, their superiors, their subordinates, but above all, their colleagues in other areas, what contribution from me do you require to make your contribution to the organization? When do you need this? How do you need it? And in what form? If cost accountants, for example, asked these questions, they'd soon find out which of their assumptions, obvious to them, are totally unfamiliar to the managers who are to use the figures. They'd soon find out which of the figures that to them are important are irrelevant to the operating people, and which figures, barely seen by them and rarely reported, are the ones the operating people really need every day. The biochemist who asks this question in a pharmaceutical company will soon find out that the clinicians can use the findings of the biochemist only if presented by the clinician's language rather than in biochemical terms. The clinicians, however, in making the decision whether to put a new compound into clinical testing or not, decide whether the biochemist's research product will even have a chance to become a new drug. The scientist in government who focuses on contribution soon realizes that he must explain to the policymaker where a scientific development might lead to. He must do something forbidden to scientists as a rule, that is, speculate about the outcome of a line of scientific inquiry. The only meaningful definition of a generalist is a specialist who can relate his own small area to the universe of knowledge. Maybe a few people have knowledge in more than a few small areas, but that doesn't make them generalists. It makes them specialists in several areas, and one can be just as bigoted in three areas as in one. The man, however, who takes responsibility for his contribution will relate his narrow area to a genuine whole. He may never himself be able to integrate a number of knowledge areas into one, but he soon realizes that he has to learn enough of the needs, the directions, the limitations, and the perceptions of others to enable them to use his own work. Even if this doesn't make him appreciate the richness and the excitement of diversity, it will give him immunity against the arrogance of the learned, that degenerative disease which destroys knowledge and deprives it of beauty and effectiveness. The right human relations. Executives in an organization don't have good human relations because they have a talent for people. They have good human relations because they focus on contribution in their own work and in their relationships with others. As a result, their relationships are productive, and this is the only valid definition of so-called good human relations. Warm feelings and pleasant words are meaningless, are indeed a false front for wretched attitudes if there's no achievement in what is, after all, a work-focused and task-focused relationship. On the other hand, an occasional rough word won't disturb a relationship that produces results and accomplishments for all concerned. If I were asked to name the men who in my own experience had the best human relations, I would name three. General George C. Marshall, Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army in World War II, Alfred P. Sloan, Jr., the head of General Motors from the early 1920s into the mid-50s, and one of Sloan's senior associates, Nicholas Dreystadt, the man who built Cadillac into the successful luxury car in the midst of the Depression, and might well have been chief executive of General Motors sometime in the 1950s, but for his early death right after World War II. These men were as different as men can be. Marshall, the professional soldier, sparse, austere, dedicated, but with great shy charm. Sloan, the administrator, reserved, polite, and very distant. And Dreystadt, warm, bubbling, and superficially a typical German craftsman of the old Heidelberg tradition. Every one of them inspired deep devotion, indeed true affection in all who worked for them. All three, in their different ways, built their relationship to people, their superiors, their colleagues, and their subordinates, around contribution. All three men of necessity worked closely with people and thought a good deal about people. All three had to make crucial people decisions, but not one of the three worried about human relations. They took them for granted. The focus on contribution by itself supplies the four basic requirements of effective human relations: communications, teamwork, self-development, and development of others. First, communications. Communications have been in the center of managerial attention these last 20 years or more. In business, in public administration, in armed services, in hospitals, in other words, in all the major institutions of modern society, there's been great concern with communications. Results to date have been meager. Communications are by and large just as poor today as they were 20 or 30 years ago when we first became aware of the need for and lack of adequate communications in the modern organization. But we're beginning to understand why this massive communications effort can't produce results. We've been working at communications downward from management to the employees, from the superior to the subordinate, but communications are practically impossible if they're based on the downward relationship. This much we've learned from our work in perception and communications theory. The harder the superior tries to say something to his subordinate, the more likely it is that the subordinate will mishear. He'll hear what he expects to hear rather than what's being said. But executives who take responsibility for contribution in their own work will, as a rule, demand that their subordinates take responsibility too. They'll tend to ask their men, "What are the contributions for which this organization and I, your superior, should hold you accountable? What should we expect of you? What's the best utilization of your knowledge and your ability?" And then communication becomes possible, becomes indeed easy. Once the subordinate has thought through what contribution should be expected of him, the superior has, of course, both the right and the responsibility to judge the validity of the proposed contribution. According to all our experience, the objectives set by subordinates for themselves are almost never what the superior thought they should be. The subordinates, or juniors, in other words, do see reality quite differently, and the more capable they are, the more willing to take responsibility, the more will their perception of reality and of its objective opportunities and needs differ from the view of their superior or of their organization, but any discrepancy between their conclusions and what their superior expected will stand out strongly. Who's right in such a difference isn't, as a rule, important, for effective communication in meaningful terms has already been established. 2. The focus on contribution. The focus on contribution leads to communication sideways and thereby makes teamwork possible. The question, "Who has to use my output for it to become effective?" immediately shows up the importance of people who aren't in line of authority, either upward or downward, from and to the individual executive. It underlies what's the reality of a knowledge organization. The effective work is actually done in and by teams of people of diverse knowledges and skills. These people have to work together voluntarily and according to the logic of the situation and the demands of the task, rather than according to a formal jurisdictional structure. In a hospital, for instance, perhaps the most complex of the modern knowledge organizations, nurses, dietitians, physical therapists, medical and x-ray technicians, pharmacologists, pathologists, and a host of other health service professionals have to work on and with the same patient with a minimum of conscious command or control by anyone. And yet, they have to work together for a common end and in line with a general plan of action, the doctor's prescription for treatment. In terms of organizational structure, each of these health service professionals reports to his own chief, Each operates in terms of his own highly specialized field of knowledge, that is, as a professional, but each has to keep all the others informed according to the specific situation, the condition, and the need of an individual patient. Otherwise, their efforts are more likely to do harm than good. In a hospital in which the focus on contribution has become ingrained habit, there's almost no difficulty in achieving such teamwork. In other hospitals, this sideways communication, this spontaneous self-organization into the right task-focused teams, doesn't occur despite frantic efforts to obtain communications and coordination through all kinds of committees, staff conferences, bulletins, sermons, and the like. The typical institution of today has an organization problem for which traditional concepts and theories are totally inadequate. Knowledge workers must be professionals in their attitude toward their own field of knowledge. They must consider themselves responsible for their own competence and for the standards of their work. In terms of formal organization, they'll see themselves as belonging to a functional specialty, whether this is biochemistry or, as in the hospital's, nursing, for example. In terms of their personnel management, their training, their records, but also their appraisal and promotion, they'll be governed by this knowledge-oriented function. But in their work, they increasingly have to act as responsible members of a team with people from entirely different knowledge areas organized around the specific task on hand. Focus on upward contribution won't by itself provide the organizational solution. It will, however, contribute understanding of the task and communications to make imperfect organization perform. Communications within the knowledge workforce is becoming critical as a result of the computer revolution in information. Throughout the ages, the problem has always been how to get communication out of information. Because information had to be handled and transmitted by people, it was always distorted by communications, that is, by opinion, impression, comment, judgment, bias, and so on. Now suddenly we're in a situation in which information is largely impersonal and therefore without any communications content. It's pure information. But now we have the problem of establishing the necessary minimum of communications so that we understand each other and can know each other's needs, goals, perceptions, and ways of doing things. Information doesn't supply this. Only direct contact, whether by voice or by written word, can communicate. The more we automate information handling, the more we'll have to create opportunities for effective communication. 3. Individual self-development. Individual self-development in large measure depends on the focus on contributions. The man who asks of himself, "What's the most important contribution I can make to the performance of this organization?" asks in effect, "What self-development do I need? What knowledge and skill do I have to acquire to make the contribution I should be making? What strengths do I have to put to work? What standards do I have to set myself?" 4. The executive who focuses on contribution also stimulates others to develop themselves, whether they're subordinates, colleagues, or superiors. He sets standards which aren't personal, but grounded in the requirements of the task. At the same time, their demands for excellence, for their demands for high aspiration, for ambitious goals, and for work of great impact. We know very little about self-development, but we do know one thing. People in general, and knowledge workers in particular, grow according to the demands they make on themselves. They grow according to what they consider to be achievement and attainment. If they demand little of themselves, they'll remain stunted. If they demand a good deal of themselves, they'll grow to giant stature without any more effort than is expended by the non-achievers. The effective meeting. The meeting, the report, or the presentation are the typical work situation of the executive. They are his specific, everyday tools. They also make great demands on his time, even if he succeeds in analyzing his time and in controlling whatever can be controlled. Effective executives know what they expect to get out of a meeting, a report, or a presentation, and what the purpose of the occasion is or should be. They ask themselves, why are we having this meeting? Do we want a decision? Do we want to inform? Or do we want to make clear to ourselves what we should be doing? They insist that the purpose be thought through and spelled out before a meeting is called, a report asked for, or a presentation organized. They insist that the meeting serve the contribution to which they've committed themselves. The effective man always states at the outset of a meeting the specific purpose and contribution it's to achieve. He makes sure that the meeting addresses itself to this purpose. He doesn't allow a meeting called to inform to degenerate into a bull session in which everyone has bright ideas, but a meeting called by him to stimulate thinking and ideas also doesn't become simply a presentation on the part of one of the members, but is run to challenge and stimulate everybody in the room. He always, at the end of his meetings, goes back to the opening statement and relates the final conclusions to the original intent. There are other rules for making a meeting productive. For instance, the obvious but usually disregarded rule that one can either direct a meeting and listen for the important things being said, or one can take part and talk. One can't do both. But the cardinal rule is to focus it from the start on contribution. The focus on contribution counteracts one of the basic problems of the executive, the confusion and chaos of events and their failure to indicate by themselves which is meaningful and which is merely noise. The focus on contribution imposes an organizing principle. It imposes relevance on events. Focusing on contribution turns one of the inherent weaknesses of the executive situation, his dependence on other people, his being within the organization, into a source of strength. It creates a team. Finally, focusing on contribution fights the temptation to stay within the organization. It leads the executive, especially the top-level man, to lift his eyes from the inside of efforts, work, and relationships to the outside, that is, to the results of the organization. Makes him try hard to have direct contact with the outside, whether markets and customers, patients and a community, or the various publics which are the outside of a government agency. To focus on contribution is to focus on effectiveness. Chapter 4. Making strength productive. The effective executive makes strength productive. He knows that one can't build on weakness. To achieve results, one has to use all the available strengths, the strengths of associates, the strengths of the superior, and one's own strengths. These strengths are the true opportunities. To make strength productive is the unique purpose of organization. It can't, of course, overcome the weaknesses with which each of us is abundantly endowed, but it can make them irrelevant. Its task is to use the strength of each man as a building block for joint performance. Staffing from strength. The area in which the executive first encounters the challenge of strength is in staffing. The effective executive fills positions and promotes on the basis of what a man can do. He doesn't make staffing decisions to minimize weaknesses, but to maximize strength. President Lincoln, when told that General Grant, his new commander-in-chief, was fond of the bottle, said, "If I knew his brand, I'd send a barrel or so to some other generals." After a childhood on the Kentucky and Illinois frontier, Lincoln assuredly knew all about the bottle and its dangers, but of all the Union generals, Grant alone had proven consistently capable of planning and leading winning campaigns. Grant's appointment was the turning point of the Civil War. It was an effective appointment because Lincoln chose his general for his tested ability to win battles and not for his sobriety, that is, for the absence of a weakness. Lincoln learned this the hard way, however. Before he chose Grant, he had appointed in succession three or four generals whose main qualifications were their lack of major weaknesses. As a result, the North, despite its tremendous superiority in men and materiel, hadn't made any headway for three long years from 1861 to 1864. In sharp contrast, Lee, in command of the Confederate forces, had staffed from strength. Every one of Lee's generals, from Stonewall Jackson on, was a man of obvious and monumental weaknesses, but these failings Lee considered, rightly, to be irrelevant. Each of them had, however, one area of real strength, and it was this strength, and only this strength, that Lee utilized and made effective. As a result, the well-rounded men Lincoln had appointed were beaten time and again by Lee's single-purpose tools, the men of narrow but very great strength. Whoever tries to place a man or staff an organization to avoid weakness will end up at best with mediocrity. The idea that there are well-rounded people, people who have only strengths and no weaknesses, whether the term used is the whole man, the mature personality, the well-adjusted personality, or the generalist, is a prescription for mediocrity if not for incompetence. Strong people always have strong weaknesses too. Where there are peaks, there are valleys. And no one is strong in many areas. Measured against the universe of human knowledge, experience, and abilities, even the greatest genius would have to be rated a total failure. There's no such thing as a good man. Good for what, is the question. The executive who's concerned with what a man can't do rather than what he can do, and who therefore tries to avoid weakness rather than make strength effective, is a weak man himself. He probably sees strength in others as a threat to himself, but no executive has ever suffered because his subordinates were strong and effective. There's no prouder boast, but also no better prescription for executive effectiveness than the words Andrew